Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Talking about suicide is not easy. And every time we discuss this issue, it seems to get more and more difficult. Well, this is a Medical Monday conversation, and during this National Suicide Prevention Week, we are addressing stigma and mental health. My guests are Donya Parker, founder and executive director of the Rock of Life Foundation, and Dr. Eushekia Woodford, chief resident of the Howard University Hospital's Department of Psychiatry. If you have a question, if you have a comment, if you have a concern, if you need help, if you need support regarding the issue of suicide, give us a call. Lines are open. Experts are in the house. Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at H. Fisher, WHUR, or you can find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Donya, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Woodford, thank you so much for joining the conversation.
Thank you so much for having me as well.
Absolutely. Dr. Woodford, let me start with you. I have a bucket full of statistics, and the overarching issue, the thing that sticks out for me, is that between 2018 and 2021, according to the CDC, there's been a 36% increase in suicides from Black people ages 10 to 24, 10 to 24. And there's also been a significant increase among Black people aged 25 to 44. From your professional perspective, what is going on with these numbers?
Sure. So, and I'm just going to add a couple of things. So you're correct. From 2018 until 2016, we've seen that increase. Suicide was actually the second leading cause of death in Black children aged 10 to 14, and the third leading cause of death in Black adolescents aged 15 to 19. So what we do know with these numbers is that we're paying more attention. So within the community, you know, the numbers, sometimes you can easily say that they're skewed. Everything doesn't get reported. But what we do know is that we're now seeing that researchers are paying more attention to mental health within the Black or African-American community. And so we're looking at suicide in the community, and we do see that these numbers are rising. And it's multifactorial, meaning there are many different reasons why we're seeing an increase in this number. With the youth and that age group that you first mentioned, one of the biggest concerns we have right now is medical professionals and social media. There's this pressure to fit in. Someone has access to you 24/7. So that's a easy avenue for them to bully you. So cyberbullying is a big thing right now that we're seeing. The stigma within our community is something that has always, I would say, have plagued or really been a huge part of the history of mental health. And what we're seeing is that is preventing people from getting help. And so with them preventing them from getting help, incidents like things in the media, all the traumas that we've been seeing, especially with racism, especially after the pandemic with George Floyd and his passing, his murder, we noticed that was some people's breaking point. So with all of those different stressors that have really been more focused within or present in the community, we've seen, too, that people aren't able to get treatment. We historically, there's been huge health disparities within the Black community. We don't have the representation. About 2% of psychiatrists, as well as 4% of psychologists, are actually Black. And then we have this ongoing history of racism and discrimination that's only growing. And then lastly, just our exposure to violence as well as trauma. Those have been historically on the rise in this time period.
Donya, when Dr. Woodford was speaking, you were nodding your head. What were you thinking?
The ages are actually younger than that. There are children that are taking their lives that are 7 and 8 years of age. But I also feel that we in this age where we have technology, there's more research, there's more ways to find help. And I think we need to start pushing that agenda as well. So that was one of the reasons why I was shaking my head. But it's within our community, especially since the pandemic, we have been talking about it more. There's more output. There's more resources people are searching for. And again, in the age of technology, it's there. We just have to look for it. We have to want it and push for it.
You lost your brother to suicide.
Yes, I lost my youngest brother, Sterling, we call him Rocky Parker, to suicide in 1994. And it goes back to what the doctor was saying about that stigma. At that time, we weren't into that technology and doing the resources. We were always raised that suicide was a white person's disease. No one black takes their lives. So I remember after my brother's passing, I went to work, and someone asked me, what did he die by? And I told him he, at that time, that word committed. So I said he committed suicide. And that person in turn said to me, black people don't take their lives. So that put that stigma back on me, and I was embarrassed to state that how my brother died, because that's what we always heard, that suicide was a white person's disease. But I'm here to tell you, no, it's not. It's anybody's disease.
Did you or your family have any inkling that there were mental health issues with your brother prior to him taking his own life, or was this a complete surprise?
It was a complete surprise. One, because of that stigma, not talking about mental illness and anything, everything. So now, doing my research and the being an advocate, the signs were there. We just didn't know the signs. So it goes back to that educating ourselves. The information is there. The education is there. And I'll talk about it to the rooftops. But the signs were there. And I know the signs were there now because of the research, things that we have done. And it was a complete surprise.
What were the signs?
Signs where he was spending more time with the family. We were a close-knit family anyway, but spending more time. And then he started being withdrawn. And the biggest thing, and I just found this out maybe 5 years ago, his best friend, he mentioned it to his best friend. What would you do if I took my life? I just found this out 5 years ago. And then I have to think about when he came to me and asked me to get a therapist for him. Never in my wildest dreams would I have thought that this was the outcome. This would have been the outcome. So it was a complete surprise. And again, it goes back to those signs. The signs were there, but because of the lack of education and not understanding what was going on, we didn't pay attention.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. This is a Medical Monday conversation. We're talking about suicide, stigma, and mental health. If you have a comment, if you have a question, if you need help, give us a call. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Dr. Woodford, this is kind of near and dear to me. I attended a funeral just this past Friday. The son of some wonderful friends lost their son to suicide. A really a magnificent young man who was doing things, going places. You want to talk about magnificent blackness and incredible mental capacity, a scholar. And I could just go on, someone who had just an explosively cheerful and kind disposition. And I will say that had to be, because he was only 25, one of the saddest funeral services that I ever attended. When you talk about signs, are there signs? What do you do, or what do you look for when there aren't even signs that, as you know, Danya was just saying, you know, were that obvious? I mean, some people don't talk about what they're thinking, what they're feeling, may not give signs, may be able to mask what they're feeling.
Sure. So I am truly sorry for both of your losses. I can't even begin to imagine, and it's one of those things that pain does is unspeakable. With regard to the signs and what you're looking for when someone isn't talking, and that conversation isn't one that you directly have with them, you're looking for things like their nonverbal communication. So someone, and thinking about Diane with your loss, you notice the withdrawal from family. So that's one of the things from family and from friends. People may say they feel empty or hopeless. They may stop going to work. A big red flag is when they may express or feel like a burden. But when they're not saying anything, how do you know? Are they getting up when they were getting up before? Or are they sleeping more? Do they look like they're fatigued or they have low energy? Are they moving slower than they were before? How's their appetite? Are they eating less or are they eating more than they normally do? You're kind of looking at everything in their environment that kind of doesn't fit the picture for that individual.
See, and for those who do not have a difficult relationship with this issue, you know, because I mean, I look, and I'll just kind of throw this out there because I know there are a lot of people really kind of struggling with this, you know, Dr. Woodford. There are times when I don't feel like talking to anybody, and there are times when I'm tired. I do not have any plans on leaving this earth by my own hand. So how is it that you can differentiate between that and someone who might? Because while I know that I have, you know, wonderful friends who will call me and say, well, we haven't heard you in a few days. Are you okay? And I will, and I will say, I'm fine. But then someone else who may take their own life may, in that same kind of conversation, say, I'm fine. And then the next day they're gone. This is not black and white science, is it, Dr. Woodford?
No, it's not. And that's probably the hardest part and why we all feel so empty when someone takes their life. So with regard to you saying that you feel tired and you are having a hard time just because you're tired.
Right.
What I would do is I would ask the question, be very direct.
Mm-hmm.
And someone may say, do you want to kill yourself? And that for us right now, that conversation may seem very difficult. But some people will tell you, I don't want to be here anymore. I'm tired. Well, whereas you may say, I'm just tired today. No, absolutely not.
Yeah, I'll call you tomorrow.
Exactly. It starts with a conversation. And you going and asking the question even helps that person in a sense that it gives them a space where they feel comfortable coming to you if they do so decide. They may not tell you the truth. They may not be honest about it.
Yeah.
But it creates an avenue.
I only have a couple of minutes left before the break, and I wanted to let our listeners know that we are going to get to your phone calls. I think it's Rogier, we're going to be talking to you, so please, I need you to stay with us at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Dr. Woodford, do you have a resource that you can share with our listeners before the break? Also, I want to ask you, Danya, the same thing, but Dr. Woodford, I mean, beyond the 988, obviously, that's, you know, everyone, I think we know that 988 emergency phone number for mental health support. But beyond that, what would you suggest?
Sure. So the Department of Behavioral Health has a hotline called the Access Helpline. And with the Access Helpline, that number is 1-888-7-WE-HELP. And so that's 1-888-7-WE-HELP. They're open 24 hours, 7 days a week. And they're there to, even if you don't know how to navigate that situation, they can certainly help you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Also, Donya, a resource from you real quick, if I could.
NOMNY.org, and they're located in 50 states, and they have every resource available, support groups and everything. NOMNY.org.
Spell that, please.
NAMI.org.
NAMI.org. .org. As always, we will be posting that information on our website, WHUR.com, after 8:30 tonight. So, Roger and Derek, please stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We're going to continue this conversation on this Medical Monday. Iron Waller is in tonight on the original Quiet Storm for John Mons. That's on WHUR. We'll be back in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. This is a Medical Monday conversation, and we're talking about suicide, stigma, and mental health. My guests are Donya Parker, founder and executive director of the Rock for Life Foundation, and Yukishia Woodford, Dr. Yukishia Woodford, chief resident of the Howard University Hospital's Department of Psychiatry. If you have a comment, if you have a question, if you need support, resources, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Roger, calling from Northwest D.C., thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I had a comment.
Sure.
I suffer from suicidal thoughts. I was suicidal before. I've been hospitalized, and I just want to say, the help is, the numbers are there, the resources are out there, the programs are there, but the help is really not there. I mean, even if we go outside of our home when we ask for help, I've asked for help. I've said it in many different ways. Like the lady said, she said it in many different ways, but she just didn't pay no attention or she didn't think about it. But it's being said, it's being told. We're saying something to people that we think are listening. When nobody listens, it's like all hope is gone. It's gone. So what do you do from that? You have to find hope somewhere else, and they find it in strangers.
Let me ask you a question. You said at one point you were suicidal. You were still with us to tell the tale. You are with us now. How are you feeling? And how did you get to the now?
Honestly, I struggle with those thoughts daily. Mm-hmm. I honestly do. But all I can tell people is keep God first. Like, I'm not a preacher, and I'm not none of that all good stuff, but there's only one God, and you keep him first. And everything that I'm doing, all the drinking and drugging and stuff you do, you keep him first. He put people in your place, and he put people in your way that will help get you where you need to be, even if you don't know him. I'm from North Carolina. I've been here 23 years, and I have been navigated through this city, even with my thoughts. People have been put in place in front of me that I have no idea would be there, and they were there in the time I needed. Just keep God first, no matter what else we're doing. Other than that, just think positive. I choose to think positive on purpose. It's a struggle every day to get up and choose to say hi to everybody I see because I want to be positive on purpose. I want to be positive because it don't take that much.
Can I ask you one more question?
Yes, sir.
You said you struggle with it now, and this is a layperson asking. Why do you struggle with it now? You know, what is it that brings those thoughts to your mind?
Honestly, it's being the black man living in America.
Okay.
I don't feel like I have my rights. They say we have rights, and my rights have been violated time and time and time, even to present day. And I go about the steps to get my rights, you know what I'm saying, vindicated or get myself heard, and then not. Go to the right proper channels and nobody listens. As a black man, then nobody's hearing me until I start beating my chest and like a porch monkey. Then, you know what I'm saying, then fighting and carrying on. Then they want to hear you. But I make complaints and I do like everybody else, but it's not, I'm not treated the same in America as my counterparts. Hmm. And that's sad. It's depressing. It's sad. I live uptown off of U Street. I stay by myself. Rent is $1,600. I think I've done pretty well for myself.
Yeah.
But people walk by me every day in my own neighborhood. I walk my dog looking at me as if I don't belong here.
I really appreciate you being honest and opening up, because I think you've informed me, but I think you've also helped some people who are outside of the space looking in. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for calling.
Each one teach one. Thank you.
Absolutely. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Derek calling from Baltimore. Derek, thanks for hanging on. What's on your mind?
Hey, how you guys doing?
Doing just fine.
I work as a police officer in the state of Maryland, and I would like to know, have you guys noticed an increase in suicide for first responders? Reason why I asked, years ago, when I was working for this police agency, my sergeant took his life, and we didn't notice no signs whatsoever. And I just want to know, have you noticed increase?
Donya, do you have any thoughts about the...
Yes, there is an increase in first responders, and it's not being reported. And I feel that the agencies need to put more effort into getting that resources. And a lot of times with the first responders, they don't want to actually admit that they're having a problem, because they have to worry about, okay, if I tell you I'm having a problem, you might take me from my job. I might lose my job. And it goes with people with security clearance. If you admit you're having mental problems, you feel that you're going to lose your clearance. So they're struggling on so many different avenues. So we need to put more emphasis and more help for those that are out there on the front line. And the other caller, I agree with him 1,000%. It's hard being an advocate, and I give you a list of resources, and half of them can't even help you. So that's a huge struggle. The crisis hotline, they only have so much resources or people that are out there volunteering. And it's going to go back. So if first responders, they're coming out there to help. If we call 911, a lot of the first responders are coming out there. A lot of them don't have the training. And then you have to think about the ones that are dealing with their own issues. So it's a struggle back and forth each way. So there is a large network, and there's a large rise of first responders that are taking their lives.
Dr. Woodford, your thoughts about what Derek is asking?
Sure. I would agree with what Diane was mentioning about the increase in rise. We have to also take into consideration who's at risk for suicide. So when we talk about men versus women, we know that men are dying by suicide at a rate that's greater than 3 times when compared to Black women. Additionally, we have seen a rise in, during the pandemic, them responding to more calls. And so you have to think about all the different traumas they're experiencing. On top of the stress that the gentleman mentioned with work, if I call out, there's still that stigma within not only our community, but also overall, are you able to function and work in this setting, in this job? At that point, that's another risk factor for them, because now they have an acute stressor. That is something else we have to take into consideration. So certainly, yes, all the factors, and I agree wholeheartedly with what Diane's mentioning, are playing a role in what we're seeing now as a rise with first responders as far as suicide.
Derek, before I let you go, how are you feeling? How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. A lot of agencies now are starting to do like a wellness program across the state of Maryland. So by having that type of program, it helps with a lot of things that we're dealing with nowadays. So I'm doing good.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad to hear that. Thank you so much for listening and calling in. I appreciate your time. Dr. Woodford, we saw after the attack on the U.S. Capitol in January of 2021, at least one suicide from one of the officers who was defending the Capitol. And we are hearing so much more about first responders trying to cope with some of the mental stresses. And I can only imagine the kind of pressure that they are under with you know, the gun violence and the accidents. I mean, certainly those things have always been there. But what would you say has changed? Is it more of the same? Have people changed? What?
I think it's a combination of both. I think that we are able to recognize things a little bit better than we were before. So we're screening more for depression and for suicide. But then also, I go back to social media and the awareness of suicide. We have people like Ms. Parker who are making sure that other people are aware of because it hits, it's close to home for her. So I think that it's a combination of the two. And what we're seeing is that overall, it may have been there, but now because people are more aware and they're advocating to make sure that, you know, we're not missing it on multiple different levels. We have 988. We have a number of other resources. You mentioned NAMI. It's something that's on our radar now that I don't think was there before.
The question I have for you, Dr. Woodford, and this is an old question for me and something I've always wanted to ask and always forget to ask, but now that it is in my mind, you're a psychiatrist. Your job is to attempt to address people's problems. How do you protect your mental health?
Sure. So, like I advocate for my patients to be their biggest advocate and have a therapist. I have my own therapist. I also see a mental health provider when I need it. But more importantly, self-care. So taking that time during the day to reset, to focus on my breath, mindfulness. Our program does a good job of wellness. We have activities to check in with all the residents, the other healthcare professionals that I work with, just to ensure that we are aware of our emotions, our feelings, and then talking about it. I talk about mental health with my family members, my coworkers, just making it so that it's more normalized and having that conversation, something that I practice.
Donya, talk to me a little bit more about the evolution of addressing stigma related to the death of your brother.
Having the conversation, being comfortable having the conversation. And at this point in my life, I have to be vulnerable. I have to tell my truth, how it affected me. It took a lot out of me. I was in a deep depression for 17 years after his death because I didn't address that trauma. So it's one, like we're doing now, having the conversation, but let's always have the conversation, not just Suicide Prevention Month, because suicides happen every day. There's 132 deaths per day. Somebody's taking their life. So it doesn't just happen once a month. Let's continue having a conversation. Let's stop being afraid to address the issue. And just like the doctor said, ask the question, ask that hard question. If you see something different, speak up. It's nothing wrong with speaking up. And for you as well, get the help. Because in the position that I'm in now, being an advocate, I still, like the doctor said, I have to advocate for myself. I have to make sure my mental is okay before I can sit out here and tell you to do something. So let's continue to have the conversation. Bring it to the forefront. Stop being afraid. And let's not address it when a actor or famous person dies by suicide. And again, let's stop doing it just Suicide Prevention Month. Bring it up. Mental illness is real. It's just like any other illness. And we need to address that. Stop sweeping it under the rug, because at one point, and I say this all the time, that rug is going to be too lumpy and we're not going to be able to step over it. So we need to bring it to the forefront. We talk about everything else under the sun, social media, somebody's child. Let's bring it to the forefront.
But Dr. Woodford, is suicide like any other illness?
Yes, it is. It, absolutely. And I would say there are layers to it. And you think about, like, someone with diabetes. It's funny because you have a whole brain, it's a whole organ. What makes you, you have to take care of it just like any other part of your body. But yes, there are stages to it, different levels, mild, moderate depression. And it's something that, just like with diabetes, it can get better and then it can get worse. And so we have to manage it throughout the whole course, just like any other medical condition.
What is the difference between the chemical imbalances and societal or other external factors regarding mental health?
Can you repeat your question for me?
I said, what is the difference between someone who may have suicidal ideations, who may be affected by chemical imbalances, as opposed to someone who is feeling the pressure of societal ills and external problems?
That is a great question. So those warning signs and symptoms that we mentioned before, they're going to last a lot longer in somebody that is, from our standpoint, clinically depressed or suffering from, we call, major depressive disorder. They're going to have those symptoms for 2 weeks. It's not going to be for a minimum of 2 weeks, and it's going to include a depressed mood or their loss of pleasure in things that once brought them joy, in addition to the thoughts of harming themselves and some other criteria. Whereas someone that may be undergoing pressure, if you take out the pressure, it will go, all of their worries and things like that will go away and they will get better. Whereas someone that is clinically depressed, you remove the pressures, that period of time passes and they're still experiencing those same symptoms that we were concerned about.
You know, I'm reminded of something that happened to me. This was years ago, and I haven't really thought about it in a really long time. So this is that moment of transparency where I was in Kansas City. As you all know, I'm from the DMV. Kansas City is the Midwest. And I was feeling low, depressed, the whole nine. Went to see a psychiatrist, 3 visits, the introductory visit, a second visit, and then a third visit. And the third visit, and this was a black psychiatrist in Kansas, which is, you know, Kansas, Missouri, which is like the DMV. And it started like this. This was an older black woman, and she said to me, "Boy, there ain't nothing wrong with you." She said, "You're homesick." She said, "Go home." And when you talk about removing those pressures, Dr. Woodford, that is exactly what happened. The minute that I moved back to the East Coast, and as I'm literally driving across country, 1,500 miles plus, with every state getting closer and closer to the familiar, I began to feel that pressure lift. Now, I will say, on a lighter note, prior to that, one of my coworkers, who was also from D.C., went home. And I said to her, this is 1999, 2000. And I said, "When you come back, can you bring me a Go-Go CD?" And you know, and it's funny, but it ain't funny.
Right.
And when I played it, and it was a CD, that's how long ago it was. It wasn't MP3. There was no, you know. But, and it made me feel a sense of home. And so, you know, to your point, Dr. Woodford, I can see how, you know, how physicians, you know, psychiatrists, as well as, of course, the, you know, the psychologists and the counselors, and if they can pinpoint, for a lot of people, pinpointing where the pressure is, if you can remove it or alter it or put the person in a place where they can control. I wasn't suicidal, but I sure wasn't feeling good. It can make a difference, Dr. Woodford.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You said earlier, Danya, that we need to talk about it, but then you also said that you were in a depression of 17 years. So this didn't happen overnight.
No.
So was there an aha moment, or when did you decide that you were going to move from beneath the cloud to activist? I mean, what was it that changed for you?
That was in 2012, and I decided I wanted to get help because it was not only affecting me, it was affecting my sons. So my sons, when my brother passed away, were 7 and 8 at the time. So he was more like their big brother versus their uncle. So people don't realize being depressed is not only affecting you, it affects everything else. I hit rock bottom. I graduated from college, bought my first house, was still working for the federal government. I still hit rock bottom, 2001, right before September the 11th. Mm. I still did not seek help. I did everything else, went to college again, and running from what I was dealing with, running from my pain, running from not accepting my brother's death. 2012, I went to my therapist, talked to her, and I finally admitted to myself that I was pissed at my brother. So once I let that out, I said, okay, enough is enough. Started going to a support group, gathered my family. We did our first suicide prevention walk. I decided I wanted to be part of something to help heal people, because I saw that it was starting to heal my family. And that's where it came from. And once I broke away from being mad at my brother, I said, okay, I need to start living. I was alive, but I wasn't living. I was hiding behind that amazing mask. Mm-hmm. Hair done, makeup looking good, but I was still hurting inside. So once I decided I wanted a change, I wanted something different, I wanted to enjoy life, my grandkids, that's when the change came about. Because you have to want it for yourself. I can keep telling someone to go get therapy, this, that, and other. Same thing with me. But you have to want it for yourself. And then you have to realize, and again, how much it hurts. You're hurting other people during this process, because people that take their lives or thinking about, they feel like they are burdened, that if I'm not here, I'm not causing any more problems. But you left a big problem on the table, and that was one of my biggest things. My brother left this here for me, for us to try to figure this out. And I had to tell a 7-year-old, an 8-year-old, and my godson that was 10, that you were no longer here. I couldn't process it, so I can only imagine what they were dealing with. My mom, that was her baby. So once you start wanting it for yourself, getting that healing, it's still a process. You still have your moments, but you still have to want it for yourself.
Dr. Woodford, much of this conversation has centered around those who are struggling with this mental health issue. But what do you recommend for those who are left behind, who are trying to process why a loved one may have taken their own life? And what do you recommend for their healing process in the immediate aftermath as well as long term?
Yeah, so I highly recommend therapy, working with a therapist to kind of talk through these things, getting professional help, because it may be hard to really express how you feel with another family member. They may also be grieving, or even a close friend of the one that you lost. I also recommend support groups. There are support groups for loss. I'll have to provide you with a list a little bit later, but getting the help that you need and taking care of yourself, practicing your own self-care to start the process and to heal. Those are going to be most important moving forward, because we do know that anyone with a family history of completed suicide, they have a higher risk of depression. And so that grief may turn into depression, it may turn into anger, it may turn into anxiety. It can present any type of mental health form. So it's very important that you get some type of professional help to kind of process these feelings.
But what does that professional help actually look like? Does it depend on what that particular person is feeling, because, you know, Danya just said that she was angry at her brother, but, and that's one, but I would imagine there are some people who may be angry, there are others who may be wondering, was this my fault? There may be others who may feel abandoned. What, you know, when you open up, you know, your book of addressing, what do you look for?
Sure. So what you're describing are the stages of grief. And with stages of grief, you can start with anger, you can start with sadness, you can start with resentment, and it just cycles. And it can just jump all over the place with those different stages of grief. And so working with a professional, they'll help you identify them. So it starts with being aware of your emotions and your feelings. And then they'll take you through a process of trying to digest them. Once you can identify them, then you can start the process of treating them. And a health professional, like a therapist, a licensed psychologist, or a clinical counselor will be able to kind of help you tease out what those are and the next steps. We have a number of different, we call them psychotherapy models, that'll help you start to begin to process those emotions, feelings, and begin to heal.
So another question about this process, less about suicide and more about therapy. If someone realizes that they need therapy for whatever, but once they get on your couch and are unable to open up or refusing for whatever reason, and I'm talking voluntarily coming into to see a Dr. Woodford, but they can't open up and talk about their problems, how is that resolved if you are not even able to open up, you know, the shell and get to the pearl of the issue?
How did process?
So it's part of the process, and it's that nonverbal communication. They walked into my office. So they made the attempt to get some kind of help. And so I'm walking with them through that process of grief, through that process of anger. If it's just them sitting on the couch, they may sit on the couch for the first three visits. And then if I look back, if you really gonna have me sit on your couch for it, yes, we're gonna process it. And one day they might say, I'm so mad, I'm so hurt, I'm disappointed. And that starts that conversation or that process. And it looks different for every person and every patient. So for me, I'm just going to keep working with them until I get to a place where they at least trust me enough to open up and create that space. Mm-hmm. We're creating the space. Eventually it will come.
Danya, you were going to say something.
It goes back to, like we were just saying, that process. And sometimes you have to meet that person where they are. Just like she said, they came through the door. They took the first step. Sitting on that couch, that's part of the process. That's meeting that person where they are.
Mm-hmm. I only have a minute or so left. I'll let you, you know, have, you know, the last minute or so, you know, Danya, to just, you know, share some of your thoughts about, you know, your process, advice, what you believe people need to know.
One, I'm going to go back to having that conversation, not being afraid to address the issue. If you see something different in your family or a friend, reach out to them. And a lot of times, someone that's going through something, a lot of times we just need to process it and talk it out. I don't need you to tell me what to do. Just listen to me. And then sometimes we can figure it out. But be that listening ear. And then if you don't know what to do, say, look, I can't handle this on my own. I'm going to get you some help. We're going to do this together. Stick by them. Don't start the process and then leave them, because it goes back to that abandonment issues. And then it's like, okay, I'm not opening up again because I opened up and this is what happened. Stay the course with the person. Be there for the person. Be a listening ear. And again, let's have the conversation. And I always say this, I grew up this way. Let's go back to the dinner table, Sunday dinner, sitting at the table. My grandfather always talked to each and every last one of us. We had a family gathering. I see people go out there. Everyone's at their table on the phone. That's your chance to have a conversation. Open up and pay attention. Please pay attention to your kids. Because the children are going through a lot. Because think about it. As an adult, sometimes we can't figure it out. We don't know how to process it. So can you imagine what a child is going through? And then they feel afraid to come to a parent to say, okay, this is what's going on. Pay attention. Be an active role and stop letting the TVs and video games raise your kids.
Yeah. I think that's a great point to end this conversation on, Donya Parker. Dr. Yushakia Woodford, thank you so much for talking to us. This is a really important conversation. It will not end here. That is the Daily Drum for this Monday, September 11th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.